from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, and I am sitting in for Tony Perkins the remainder of this week. Well, almost 200 flights were canceled to and from Hong Kong Monday, and another 300 were canceled today as thousands of pro-democracy protesters shut down one of the busiest airports in Asia following violent clashes with police over the weekend. In just a minute, I'll talk with Henry Olson, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, about his prediction of what will happen in the standoff between China and Hong Kong and his advice to President Trump. In my second segment, the Tennessee legislature is considering the passage of a total ban on abortion. Republican State Senator Kerry Roberts, who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee and heard testimony in the bill, will join me. At the bottom of the hour, Teen Vogue is using Snapchat to instruct teens on how to get an abortion. I'll talk with Patrina Mosley, Family Research Council's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. And at 42 past the hour, a California teacher who calls himself Mix instead of Mr. or Mrs. distributed to students a gender unicorn worksheet in the middle of his science class in middle school, plus the pro-family advocates' opposition to California's graphic sex ed curriculum continues to grow. I'll talk with Emily Zenos, a mother of eight, who is project coordinator for Ask Me First Minnesota, an initiative of the Minnesota Family Policy Council that educates citizens on the consequences of the transgender trend. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or me if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. And let's go immediately to our first story as things have begun to ramp up overseas. The occupation of Hong Kong's international airport by anti-government protesters Monday presented China with an unwelcome choice. Allow Hong Kong to move forward toward a full democracy or use its own military to forcibly suppress the pro-democracy protesters. Almost 200 flights were canceled yesterday, with another 300 flights canceled today in and out from Hong Kong's airport, as thousands of protesters shut down one of the busiest airports in Asia for the fifth straight day in the airport, following violent clashes with police over the weekend. Let's listen to this soundbite from CNN, in which a reporter is describing the scene at the airport.
We continue to follow breaking news here on CNN. Hong Kong's international airport is now canceling all departing flights as thousands of protesters continue to swarm into the terminal. This is a live picture of the crowd, which is growing by the hour. This is the 10th straight weekend of clashes between Hong Kong police and pro-democracy protesters. At least 9 people were hurt in the latest round of demonstrations. There's been a lot of violence back and forth, police using tear gas and rubber bullets, protesters hurling petrol bombs and bricks.
What we saw this afternoon was that there were so many protesters in the arrivals area that they spilled up and over into the departure area and started to block passengers trying to reach the check-in desk. We watched as airport staff was trying unsuccessfully to control the situation, but it was apparent by mid-afternoon local time that the airport simply could not function under these conditions.
A few hours ago, President Trump tweeted that China's armed police were assembling in Shenzhen, a city bordering Hong Kong, in an apparent display of force. Joining me now with his analysis is Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who focuses on how America's political order is being upended by populist challenges from the left and the right. He is an opinion columnist for The Washington Post and just had a piece out yesterday. He writes daily pieces focusing on politics, populism, foreign affairs, and conservative thought. Henry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, let me ask you a question. You reminded us in your Washington Post column that Hong Kong was handed over to China by the British in 1997, and there was an arrangement at that time called One Country, Two Systems. The idea was Hong Kong would keep its own political and economic system for at least 50 years while handing ultimate sovereignty in matters of military and foreign affairs over to Beijing. But the ultimate impact of this system has actually been not what Beijing's leaders may have hoped for. What has been the result of this two-system policy?
Well, I mean, the result is that for the last 22 years, Hong Kong residents have been living essentially like Westerners, but without a full democracy. And the young people want more of the West, not less of it. But Beijing will ultimately want Hong Kong to become less Westernized and more like the mainland. And that's just a choice that there's no way to compromise around. And that's what's behind the occupation of the airport, the weeks of protest, and this has now been bubbling under the surface and popping up for years. It is not something that Beijing can wish away.
In fact, you mentioned in your piece that these Hong Kong residents, this particular generation, has experienced nothing but a democratic system. They have understood the freedom and the prosperity of a Western civilization for many effects. They remain Chinese in terms of their ethnicity and their identity. They maintain Chinese traditions, but really they have known nothing but freedom. So this is so much bigger than the initial extradition bill that was the incitement of this whole process, isn't it?
Well, the extradition bill was another way of showing the incompatibility between living like a mainland Chinese and living like a Westerner, because the extradition bill would have meant that if you were arrested by the Hong Kong police, you could have been sent to Beijing, where you had none of those rights, where you had no free and independent judiciary, where you had no serious right to counsel. And that was Beijing's attempt to slowly begin to move towards one country, one system, where the West, Hong Kong, was going to become like Beijing. And that's why it was a touchstone for the ongoing protest, because the Western democracy movement in Hong Kong wants exactly the opposite.
You write about the fact that this one country, two systems notion was really originally a flawed premise. How so?
Well, because one country, two systems can only work if you genuinely have one country. And one country means one shared sense of ideas or something that you can unite around. I think that Beijing had thought that, well, these people living under British colonial rule are really the same as the rest of us who are living under tyrannical rule from Beijing. But in fact, that's not true. The Hong Kong Chinese have developed a different nationality, that of being a Hong Kong Chinese. They are Chinese and Western simultaneously. So there aren't one country. There's one ethnicity, but there's two countries. There's the mainland Chinese and there's the Hong Kong Chinese. And you can't have one country when there's really two nationalities, at least not a democratic one.
So obviously for a totalitarian regime like China, the Communist Party will not accept the continuation of a two-system governance model. Obviously, this was originally a fig leaf for Chinese communist imperialism, but to have to resign themselves to the fact that this democracy has broken off with its own form of free leadership, governance, and even a Western-style economic system really gives the Chinese an unthinkable premise for the Communist Party, which is totalitarian, and also defies what they have done to actually attempt a land grab in the first place. There is no, ultimately, I believe, no stopping the Chinese from now moving forward with brute force action. And just today, we see President Trump tweeting about troops assembling in the border city of Shenzhen. Do you see military action as an ultimate outcome here?
Look, the Chinese have to decide whether they want to keep Hong Kong. They've been relying on Hong Kong police and implicit submission as the way to paper over the fact that they really run the place. And the protesters are saying, no, we're not going to submit anymore. And there are so many of them, the Hong Kong police are stretched to the limit to keep these people. If this continues for a few more days, then the Chinese are going to have to act. And that means they're going to have to use their own troops. And that's going to put an end to one country, two system, because it'll be clear then that it'll be one country, one system. And that's a system that's dictated by Beijing, regardless of what the citizens of Hong Kong want.
So if Beijing intervenes in Hong Kong, you've made some suggestions to President Trump. What are those suggestions?
I think that the president, if Beijing intervenes in Hong Kong, it's clear that there's one country, one system. And Hong Kong right now, because it's supposedly independent in some way, has its own trade deals. It's its own different member of the World Trade Organization. I think if China intervenes, the president should rip the fig leaf away and say, since you're part of China, you'll be treated as the rest of China. And that means tariffs will be extended on goods and services to Hong Kong. I also think he should consider making a special grant of visas to Hong Kong residents so that they can be entered into the United States and other Western countries as refugees, because ultimately the wealth of a country isn't its things, it's its people.
What's the ultimate choke point here? Do you think there is a point at which there is an element of no return? Now we know we are weeks and weeks into these consecutive protests, and they've gotten increasingly violent, and now they are affecting travel in and out of the Hong Kong province itself. So where is the ultimate point of no return here with Hong Kong and China?
We're probably only a couple of days away from it. If there's no way to keep the protesters from shutting down the airport on a daily basis, then with using Hong Kong's resources, then the Chinese are going to have to come in and shut it down for the Hong Kong authorities. And there's only a couple more days, I think, that the protesters need to keep it up before it hits that point. And then the question, when it hits that point, China's either going to have to send the troops in or what they're going to have to do is back down in a way that will inevitably lead towards the full democratization of Hong Kong because the protesters will not accept fig leaves.
No, they won't. They understand exactly what's at stake here. And you wisely quoted Abraham Lincoln, who said that a house divided against itself cannot stand. It must be all one thing or another, which in this case seems fairly apropos to the situation between China and Hong Kong. My guest has been Henry Olson, Senior Fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins the remainder of this week. Well, coming up, the Tennessee legislature has taken a bold step and is considering the passage of a total ban on abortion in their state legislature. Republican State Senator Carrie Roberts, who serves on the Judiciary Committee, joins me next to discuss what he heard from witnesses today. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins the remainder of your week on this Tuesday edition. Well, they struggled to pass a six-week abortion ban earlier this year, but Tennessee lawmakers are back to the drawing board and are now considering a total ban on the procedure. Yesterday and today, the state's Judiciary Committee heard testimony from more than 20 witnesses and debated an 11-page amendment to its stalled fetal heartbeat bill. If the changes are adopted, the legislation will ban abortion once a woman knows she's pregnant. Joining me now, fresh from the legislative battlefield, is Tennessee State Senator Kerry Roberts, who represents the 25th District of Tennessee. He's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, actively involved in Tennessee Right to Life, and received the 2018 Award for Conservative Excellence from the American Conservative Union. Senator Roberts, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you for having me today.
So I have a lot of questions about this bill, particularly what may also be on our listeners' minds. How did this bill evolve from a heartbeat bill, which has obviously some very salient talking points? We understand heartbeat bills, they have name recognition. Abortion stops a beating heart, we automatically think, to its current incarnation, which is even more restrictive. So the legislature seems to be going in the opposite direction of some other states. Tell me how it came to this point.
Well, as you know, there are several heartbeat bills out there that have been passed by other states, and heartbeat bills absolutely positively make a statement that a state legislature is pro-life. But you know what? That's a battle to win, and we're trying to win the war. The war is, can we overturn Roe versus Wade? And we didn't believe that a heartbeat bill was the vehicle to do that. We've not seen any indication that the Supreme Court, as these heartbeat bills are being struck down across the country, we didn't see any indication that the Supreme Court would hear a heartbeat bill. And if that's the case, if that's not going to happen, we felt like we needed a different approach, a different bill that would actually attract the attention of the Supreme Court in hopes that they would hear it with an eye towards overturning Roe versus Wade, or at least kind of pulling back the Casey standard.
So you're thinking about the heartbeat bill specifically. You were not convinced that the heartbeat bill would be significant enough, would be substantial enough to draw the interest of the Supreme Court. And I have a theory as to why this is, and I've done a little research. Can you tell us why that is? Why not a heartbeat bill?
Well, we haven't seen any. Well, first of all, they haven't thus far. And even if you look at some of the writings of Scalia, it kind of, if you will, telegraph perhaps that the court wasn't going to hear that. And more important, or to kind of delve in a little bit differently, you know, the whole Roe versus Wade is kind of, I'm going to say it this way, it was evaluated in kind of a 14th Amendment framework. It was considered within a 14th Amendment framework, and there was a lot of talk, you know, not only about the woman's rights, but then when we get into what actually is the unborn baby and what is viability, and there's all this ambiguity about viability. So a heartbeat bill just basically comes forth and says, "Hey, let's clear up that ambiguity for you. Let's say that it's viable when it has a heartbeat," and that may or may not be true. So when you go to the bill that we have now and the way that it's written, it really starts to bring forth arguments about personhood, and it kind of shifts the framework from the 14th Amendment to the 9th Amendment, which basically says, you know what, if it's not enumerated, there's still other rights that you have that are rooted in our common law. And within our common law is the idea that, you know, that life or that personhood actually can predate birth. Because if you look at, you know, unborn children can have property rights. You know, they can be heirs to an estate. Or or if an unborn child is killed in a car accident, you know, a drunk driver hits a mother and an unborn child, then there'll be two counts of vehicular homicide. So in all other areas of law, you know, rooted in our common law, we're giving, you know, personhood to an unborn child. We're just not doing it with respect to abortion because of Roe versus Wade. So it's trying to shift the argument into kind of a way that you know, the Supreme Court hasn't considered before. And the Supreme Court is very focused on precedent. You know, we talk about stare decisis, you know, or has it been settled? Has it been looked at elsewhere? We're not going to look at it again. And so we're trying to give them something that four justices look at and say, well, that's interesting. We hadn't contemplated that before. And that was the goal of the rewrite of our bill. It wasn't to make it necessarily more restrictive. It was to make it a bill that we thought the Supreme Court would be more interested in.
So here we've got a Senate Judiciary Committee. There is a breakdown of 7 Republicans and 2 Democrats. What is your anticipation that this will be problematic for passage? Do you think will jump across a party line?
You would think it would be very easy with a 7-2 majority, because not only is it a 7-2 majority, but it's an extremely pro-life 7-2. But I'm gonna take a step back for a minute, and I need people to understand the Tennessee General Assembly. It's probably one of the most pro-life General Assemblies in the state, in the United States of America. And just, you know, back in 2014, we did a constitutional amendment, a pro-life constitutional amendment in the state of Tennessee. So we're very pro-life. So a lot of us don't feel like we have to make a pro-life statement. We feel like we're free to move beyond the statement to try and do something that will actually end abortion. And, you know, if you pass a heartbeat bill, you don't end abortion in your state. A court immediately strikes it down. Not a single life is saved. The whole goal is that the Supreme Court would hear it and somehow it would overturn Roe versus Wade. And we just don't think that's going to happen with a heartbeat bill. So that begs the question of, well, why do a heartbeat bill? Why not do something that you think would be more effective? Well, then you get into this. You get people who disagree with this and say it's going to cost us money, and that makes them pull back a little bit. And so we have to work around that too.
Tennessee State Senator Kerry Roberts, who sits on the Judiciary Committee, has been my guest. A vote is upcoming when the legislature reconvenes in January of 2020. We will be following closely. This is Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Teen Vogue magazine is telling teens how to get an abortion on Snapchat. We will be joined by Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, next.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is the website for the podcast. We have plenty of resources there. Be sure and visit it after today's program. Well, Teen Vogue posted a Snapchat story this past weekend that instructs teenagers on how to obtain abortions, including how to navigate parental consent or avoid it altogether. Teen Vogue Snapchat story was featured on Snapchat's Discovery page, among a variety of other stories. Usually it's a 24-hour snap displaying news and pop culture content that can cost advertisers around $50,000 a day. Not cheap. Joining me with her analysis is Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. Patrina, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Happy to be back. Thanks, Sarah.
Before we talk about this latest push for abortion in pop culture, can you explain to those of us who are listening what Snapchat is and how it works? And I will say this, I have told my children, no Snapchat for anyone in the house. It's a way to post and delete naked pictures of yourself. Is that a pretty accurate disappearing act that I've described here?
That is how it can work. I am not on Snapchat myself. There's way too many social media platforms to keep up with these days. But Snapchat virtually works where instead of tweeting messages or Facebook messages, you can send videos that will disappear in less than 24 hours. So it can be used and definitely has been used for pornography and for luring children through to get involved with sex trafficking. So it is a very... It could be used very dangerously, let's just say that.
So preteens and teens use Snapchat all the time. It is sort of the platform that's preferred by this particular age group. 92% of U.S. teenagers aged 12 to 17 use Snapchat. How many 18 to 24-year-olds use the app?
Oh, about 94%. It is majority of that age group that uses Snapchat.
And the content was posted on Snapchat from a June Teen Vogue article, How to Get an Abortion If You're 18. Here is how a portion of it reads. Imagine you're 16, you're pregnant, and you don't want to be. How do you go about getting an abortion if you're under 18? Read on to find out more. Patrina, talk to me a little bit about how specific this article was and how specific they got in terms of techniques and things to do.
Well, at first glance of this article, you think they would go into the techniques, but really that doesn't work into their favor, because if people really understood what abortion was, nobody would be for this willy-nilly. So they did not do that. Instead, what they tried to do with this article was basically create many activists for, number one, abortion laws in the state that do have parental consent to say, look, this is a bad thing to let your parents know that you're considering this. And secondly, to reinforce the idea that being pro-life is being not pro-women, being pro-life is being pro-wanting to control someone else's body. And that's totally not the case. So this piece was purely propaganda. And actually, Sarah, it reeks of a Planned Parenthood tactic that mm-hmm. wants to put a wedge between children and their parents. It's very scary.
It actually was very funny. I read through this article and then went to the Teen Vogue article itself, and I thought, my goodness, it's almost as if a Planned Parenthood clinic operator wrote this article. And in fact, I'm going to read a section here that will make your toes curl. And this is from the Teen Vogue article. I am quoting the author here. One thing I've learned while researching and reporting on these issues is that supposedly anti-abortion Americans often get abortions. They often help their children procure abortions. You know those activists who stand outside clinics holding signs adorned with Bible verses and pictures of fetuses? Even they sometimes get abortions. Dr. Yashika Robinson, a board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health and a medical director at Alabama Women's Health Center, in a state that just passed a near-total abortion ban, says she has performed the procedure on some of the very people who protest abortions. So if you don't think this particular article, feigning itself to be a helpful guide to navigating a frightening situation, isn't politicized, I have some swampland to sell you. Doesn't the Snapchat story even offer counsel on how to pay for abortion and navigate parental consent, ways to get around it?
Yes, they even let these kids know that there are certain states that have abortion funds where they can procure funds to pay for an abortion if they don't want their parents to know. They inform them about in certain states you can have a judicial bypass, which allows teenagers to go to judges and to present their case of why they need to have an abortion and why they need to not let their parents know. And some idiot judge out there will say, yeah, sure, you're a minor, you can get an abortion. Now, this piece, Sarah, is crazy on so many levels, because just like you said, number one, it's purely propaganda from Planned Parenthood, and it is undoubtedly the most scariest thing I think I've seen from Teen Vogue. I mean, they've put out some pretty crazy pieces, but this one by far is very daunting, and it's important for parents to be their child's best friend now more than ever, especially with these social media platforms. Know what's going on these items.
Teen Vogue is not a magazine my daughter, who is 12, going on 13, will be reading now or in the future. You are listening to Washington Watch. My guest has been Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. Well, coming up in our last segment of the day, we have tons to talk about in the state of California and elsewhere about public education, which seems to have reached peak lunacy. I'll be talking with Emily Zenos, a mother of eight, project coordinator for Ask Me First Minnesota, coming up next.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christian's call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I am filling in for Tony Perkins today and the remainder of your week. Well, a California middle school science teacher was asked to stop handing out a worksheet titled The Gender Unicorn, provided by Trans Student Educational Resources, which explains gender identity, gender expression, and attraction, all within the context of how to advance the trans narrative. Denaire Middle School science teacher Luis Alvarez, who is a male biologically, but has students refer to himself by the gender-neutral title Mix instead of Mr. or Mrs., handed out the worksheet on the first day of school in his science class. Joining me now with her analysis on this and other education insanity across the coast is Emily Zenos, who is the mother of 8 children, and as far as I'm concerned, she's warranted statehood and sainthood, and the project coordinator for Ask Me First Minnesota, an initiative from the Minnesota Family Council that educates citizens on the consequences of the transgender trend. She's distributed to the development of the Parent Resource Guide, which will prepare parents across America to engage with their child's public school regarding the transgender issue. Emily, welcome to Washington Watch. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me on, Sarah.
Well, on a broader level, let's talk about what's happening in the California education system overall. Now, we know California has a tendency to be aberrant from the rest of the country, thankfully, but the Ninth Circuit, which we'd like to refer to in our legal studies as the Nutty Ninth, because it was always an outlier and just a little bit off from the rest of jurisprudence. There's a clip that we have from KTLA, which kind of sets the stage as to what's going on in California public education. Let's listen.
Parents across the state say the new sex ed program is too inappropriate, adding the curriculum sexualizes children as young as kindergarten age. State education officials overhauled its sexual education guidance for public school teachers with gender identity and safe sex practices, amongst other subjects being covered. Now they say the main one that they are having a hard time with is the LGBTQ inclusive language and safe trafficking context, which will be covered. Some parents saying it's all too explicit for kids this young and too graphic. The framework tells teachers that students in kindergarten can identify as transgender and offer tips for how to talk about this. According to state officials, the goal is not to cause confusion for these kids, but rather for them to develop awareness at a young age that these expressions do exist.
Oh, sorry. I can't help but laugh a little bit. The goal is not to cause confusion. That just happens to be the absolute certain outcome in every one of these instances. So we're going to talk about the sex ed curriculum, but let's talk first about this particular transgender worksheet handed out by Mix Alvarado in the Unified School District in Denair. So this is a transgender worksheet. Seventh and eighth graders are asked to fill out this form handed out by their teacher. Can you explain a little bit, Emily, about what this notion of the gender unicorn worksheet is and the group that's provided it?
Well, you know, the gender unicorn looks so harmless and adorable as this little purple, chubby unicorn. But I think that if we use the gender unicorn, it's sort of a key to transgender ideology in general and the ideas that they're trying to communicate to young children. In this situation, we're talking about middle school kids, but I've heard of kids as young as kindergarten being introduced to the gender unicorn. Mm. Essentially, it's a meme used by a lot of radical activist groups that have made their way into public schools to teach children something that's frankly an irrational and impossible concept. At core, what the gender unicorn says is that your body doesn't tell you who you are. Instead, the gender unicorn breaks kids up into five different categories that are all rooted in choice or feeling, mm-hmm. and tells kids this is how they can know who they really are. So we've got gender identity and gender expression, even sex, which is listed on the gender unicorn worksheet, is called or referred to as assigned at birth. Again, that's a choice. It's a choice someone else made about you. If your sex is assigned at birth, then apparently your doctor just sort of arbitrarily chose whether or not you were male or female. I think that's really dangerous because if our body tells us who we are, if it's our sex that tells us who we are, then we've got the freedom to do whatever we want. You know, the clothing I wear, the hobbies I take up, the career I choose doesn't change me from a woman into a man, right? Nothing can change my sex. But if we tell kids that the choices and the feelings that they have can change who they are, imagine how that's going to make the little girl who's kind of a tomboy feel. Imagine how that's going to make the little boy who likes dance and he likes to play with little dolls feel. Those kids are now going to be confused that their body doesn't tell them who they are, but that their choices and their behaviors do. That's deeply confusing to young children.
Absolutely it is. And in fact, beginning this kind of a narrative, this reductionist logic of giving, for example, women nothing more than an assemblage of body parts and clothing items really eliminates all of the work. And you and I have sort of written about this in the same forums. It eliminates all of the work that the women's liberation movement did for so long post-sexual revolution to make sure females are a protected class in federal law and remain so. So we see the ongoing implications, for example, with Selena Sewell's case against the Connecticut Inter Association for Athletics and Track. We see the privacy issues that come up on school field trips and the use of bathrooms. So here this teacher is taking it upon himself to exercise what is tantamount to a bully pulpit to hand out a worksheet on the first day of class by Trans Student Educational Resources. Do we know anything about this organization other than they are a trans activist group?
I actually don't have any other details to share with you about them, except for that they have shared some of the more popular memes that schools use. Schools tend to refer to TSER or Trans Educational Student Resources for some of the graphics, the infographics that they hand out in classrooms. They have a very popular one about preferred pronouns that I've seen schools share in the past. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't get more popular than this gender unicorn. And I like that you brought up the fact that, you know, the ramifications of telling children or really anyone that sex doesn't determine who we are, that it's not some sort of unchangeable fact, but that it's a chosen state. The ramifications are really unbelievable, right? Because, you know, for one, now we're having to refer to outdated sex stereotypes to determine who's male and who's female. It depends on the sort of clothing you wear or the way you behave or the friends that you have. But it also doesn't give us any meaningful way to provide for fair sports opportunities, like you mentioned, right. Selena Sewell. If sex or identity is based on our choice or our say-so, then we have no coherent way of ensuring fair play for girls in sports. So if this is the outcome of something that looks benign, like our little gender unicorn here, we need to have our eyes open as parents in terms of, is this in the classroom? Is the teacher planning on bringing it to the classroom? These are questions we can bring to our teacher, to our school officials. I think the time is now to make that appointment with our teachers and school employees so that we know what's coming up and we can let our teacher know our student, our child is not going to be subjected to this.
I love that you brought up the fact that really if you whittle this down to its most essential elements, the singular force against this kind of insanity, these legal fictions that are beginning at earlier and earlier phases. And of course, why not convince children as young as 5 and 6 that sex is fungible and changeable? Because what you've done is you have secured an entire generation of individuals committed to the same notion, the same sort of peak lunacy and wokeism that the rest of us are trying to fight because it is so patently untrue. So here, Luis Alvarado, who's in his second year teaching, passes out this worksheet, does not have permission to do so. The principal, Amanda Silva, sort of incidentally making rounds during the second period class and goes in to tell him not to hand it out. The estimates are apparently that 50 students or so received the worksheet. But we know California schools, thank you, major curricular overhaul, required that this particular topic be addressed in health class. And so the singular disagreement was that the forum was incorrect. It was a science class as opposed to a health class. And so that's where the problem was, which, again, this just absolutely blows my mind. So message is great, just we put it in the wrong place. Doesn't give me much hope for California public schools.
Right, but I don't want anyone who's listening to think that this is just happening in California. It's certainly yes. happening in California, but we have a number of states who have passed whose departments of education have adopted documents typically called something like transgender guidance. These are not binding rules that schools have to follow, but it's sort of a way for the state Department of Education to strong-arm schools into introducing gender identity ideology into the classroom. So my state, Minnesota, has something called a transgender toolkit. It's, again, it's only guidance, but many school officials read this guidance document as if it's a threat of a lawsuit or of a human rights discrimination complaint if they don't follow the guidance. And the result is that schools are introducing this curricula without input from parents. Parents don't know that this is going on. So what I recommend that parents do is at the beginning of the year, you know, introduce yourself, go into the principal's office or go to the school board and ask, is there any of this information in the classroom? Because you as a parent are the primary educator. The school is actually there to help you in your duty to educate your child.
Right.
That school only operates because you have, you know, generously offered to let them educate your child. So a project that I've been working on recently with a number of experts in law, education, medicine, lots of different areas, is something called a parent resource guide. This is a guide that's going to be accessible to parents in all 50 states. It describes the health consequences of the transgender trend. It talks about the confusing terminology. We offer a wealth of constructive ideas for parents who want to work with their schools to, I would say, bring about a truly inclusive environment. Because no kid should be made to feel that their interests or their behaviors make their body wrong. Because no mm-hmm. child's body is wrong. every child should be made to feel welcome and safe at the school. And I think policies that enshrine gender identity ideas are frankly dangerous for children. And I think that it's going to be parents that turn the ship around.
I would agree with that. We are, after all, as you so rightly put, we are the primary educators of our children. We have strictly handed over temporary daily opportunity to influence these kids' lives. And we are so content in our educational system to now push socially divisive, progressive agendas at the cost of American education that it is no wonder that our scores are failing. This is just second and third generation from the failed experiment that was Common Core when we were attempting to produce future Marxist workers on an assembly line and push through different theories of whether or not we could create sameness in education while pushing through sort of the first iterations of this left-wing agenda. Let's see what we have to say about unions. Let's see what we have to say about the proliferation of Islamophobia. Let's see what we have to say about homophobia as represented specifically in a right-wing fundamental format. So this is kind of where we were naturally headed. I hate to say that this is sort of the end of this particular tunnel, because what I've learned, and I'm sure you're aware, is that things can always get stranger. But I want to go back to this resource guide. Where can our listeners get a hold of this? Because it is such an important tool that I myself cannot wait to get my hands on it.
Yes, I would love it if parents would reach out to me at askmefirstmn@gmail.com. And at that email address, you can just let me know that you would like to request a download of the guide, and I will get you that link as soon as we have it up. We're just in the final stages of editing, and we look forward to releasing it to the public in September. It's going to be a fantastic and comprehensive tool for parents across the country to engage in a charitable but firm way on behalf of the safety of every single child in our public schools.
That's Ask Me First, MN, as in the abbreviation for Minnesota, at Gmail. The website for the Family Policy Council is mfc.org. There are a wealth of resources there, and Emily Zenos led the charge on this excellent resource that has really been something I personally have looked forward to, that I know you as our listeners will individually benefit from. As Emily said, this is not just California lunacy. This is coming state to state, school board to school board, school to school. We encourage you to be alert and be the strongest, most vocal advocates for your children. They are, after all, yours alone. You've been listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. I've been sitting in for Tony Perkins. We'll see you tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.